Welcome to the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma and I'm chairman of the GAS program at the Institute. I'm today joined by Professor Jonathan Stern, founder of the GAS program at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies and distinguished research fellow, to discuss his recent paper, Challenges to the Future of LNG, Decarbonisation, Affordability and Profitability, that was published in October 2019. Jonathan, nice to see you.
Very nice to be here.
Well, look, you've now authored four papers on the subject of decarbonisation, the future of gas and decarbonising European energy markets in markets which you published in January 2017, the challenges for the future of gas, unburnable or unaffordable, in December 2018, narratives for the natural gas in decarbonising European gas markets in February 2019. So now you have this paper, this fourth paper. So why don't we start by asking, what were the key conclusions of the earlier papers and why this fourth paper at this time and why focus on LNG?
So the key conclusions of the earlier papers were that the advocacy narrative which mm-hmm. the gas community has advanced, which is essentially gas has lower CO2 emissions from combustion than other fossil fuels, was a perfectly respectable argument, but it didn't really have any traction with policymakers, certainly in Europe and a little bit wider than that.
Right.
And also that the gas community needs to come up with a narrative as to how it is going to decarbonise what is a fossil fuel mm-hmm. which emits carbon and other emissions. Mm-hmm. So the reason for doing this paper is that LNG has now become so important in the gas current and future prospects that it's important to say something about how LNG projects should be thinking about decarbonising this product.
Mm. It's interesting actually, because just thinking back, you know, your narratives paper is now a year old. Have things changed in that year, or do you think we're in the same situation as we record in February 2020?
I think things have changed in relation to policymakers starting to become a little bit more clear. Mm-hmm. What is disturbing is that when you go to major conferences and you hear CEOs talking about the future of gas, they're still putting forward the advocacy narrative rather than what I think is the importance of a decarbonisation narrative.
That's interesting. Okay. Well, look, let's specifically talk about your LNG paper. And in that, you say that combustion along the LNG value chain equates to 11 to 13% of the gas produced at the wellhead, which means that an LNG project has significantly higher emissions than a typical pipeline gas counterpart. So does that mean that LNG will have issues supplying into Europe in a post-COP21-25 goal world?
I think it will have issues, and since the paper was published, we've mm-hmm. discovered that the Commission is going to bring out a methane strategy in the summer of this year, right, which I think will set out what companies have to do in terms of saying what emissions of methane their gas deliveries and possibly oil deliveries mm-hmm. and coal deliveries actually embody. And that is partly what the whole paper is about, of saying you need to get ready for this, guys.
It was interesting, you mentioned this particular European Union initiative, which of course has come on the patch since your paper. But that's going to be both for gas pipeline supplies as well as LNG supplies, yes?
Well, we don't exactly know what it's going to say, but mm-hmm. it apparently is setting out what they've called the MRV strategy, mm-hmm. measurement, reporting and verification. Now, we don't know whether it's going to impose limits, whether it's going to suggest limits, but it is the start of saying to the gas community, you need to be clear about what your emissions are mm-hmm. and you need to get them certified, and we are going to require that in the future.
Now, Titchy, because you said what you're effectively also saying is that, you know, decarbonisation is therefore likely to impact on the expected return on investments for new LNG liquefaction investments.
Well, I think that's right, because the actual reporting requirements are not going to cost very much.
Right.
The measuring requirements will cost something, but it's not grave. Mm-hmm. The key question is, what are you going to do as these requirements become more onerous in the future? And should you be planning for this now to perhaps reduce the impact on your bottom line of having to take these measures?
So what you're saying is that, you know, investors should see decarbonisation on their radar for new project developers. It should really be there. This is important.
Well, absolutely. And especially if you haven't taken FID yet and you can take measures now which will reduce the amount you need to invest later to decarbonize, that could be very important.
Yeah, exactly. And, okay, well, you've discussed in previous podcasts about advocacy, and we briefly talked about in this podcast earlier on, and the gas narratives that you referred to in the title of your earlier papers, but does that also really apply to the energy sector?
I think outside Europe, it is less important. In other words, the advocacy narrative that just you need to switch from coal to gas still works well, particularly in large part of Asia. But if we are going to be serious about meeting even COP21 targets, never mind net zero targets, emissions of any greenhouse gas emissions will become increasingly important.
And it was interesting looking at certain graphs that people are presenting at conferences now. They're actually using their emissions as a means of promoting their projects.
And that's exactly what they should be doing. They should be boasting about, these are our emissions, they're lower than previously, they're lower than competitors, and in fact, we can lower them further by different sets of measures.
Well, the danger is, because you and I were at a conference just a matter of weeks ago, that you get different people promoting different numbers because they've been calculated on a different basis. So getting that commonality is going to be difficult, isn't it?
It's about commonality, but principally it's about transparency. Mm-hmm. What we want to know is, what is the methodology by which you're calculating your emissions, and who is certifying that you are actually doing this? It's a big problem here in two respects. Firstly, this is an industry where transparency has never been high. Confidentiality is a way of life.
Secondly,
there is a huge problem about agreeing a methodology because, reasonably enough, there's different methodologies of measurement out there.
Yeah. So we agree that there's an importance of being able to have a basis of measurement, and that's got to be transparent. But what could happen if LNG chain emissions are not certified then?
Well, my view is that at some stage, in Europe first, perhaps in other jurisdictions as well, but certainly in Europe, if you're landing any gas, and including LNG, in Europe, if you haven't got certificates which show what the greenhouse gas emissions are, you will be deemed to be of a certain greenhouse gas level, and your LNG will be worth less because offsets will need to be bought.
Right, so therefore you're effectively saying that, you know, different value chains, be it gas or be it LNG value chain, will have different values.
Exactly.
Interesting. Okay. Now, you say that all information should be public, you know, but, and you would also mention the confidentiality, it being a way of life within the LNG sector. How are you going to get around that? Because, you know, if you've got confidentiality provisions, you know, surely the information cannot be public.
But we're not talking here about the commercial terms. We're not talking about, you know, what's your price, what's your indexation, although, frankly, I think in a modern world, that's not so important as it was. Mm-hmm. We're talking about, if you're claiming that your LNG has this level of emissions, upstream, shipping, liquefaction, then where are your certificates to prove it? And that is not a confidentiality issue. That's a fairly scientific, technical issue of measurement.
It's because you and I have been talking about price and LNG and disagreeing and agreeing at times.
Indeed.
Over the last 10 years, I think, you know.
Or longer.
But we've been seeing rapid change, and I think, you know, I think in the next few years there'll be more rapid change. But do you think we're going to see that similar change on this subject, on the emission subjects, have we seen in the pricing structure?
Oh, well, I think we are. And I mean, for me, as I've written extensively on this before I started on decarbonisation, you know, the gas world has to come into contact with economics 101, which says that the price of a product should equal the supply and demand of that product in the market into which it's being sold. Now, most of the gas world has come into that, but not Asia yet. Mm-hmm. But I think with the current pressures where JCC is and where JKM is, this is just a matter of time before it starts.
But it's interesting, but one of the drivers, you know, and I'm just trying to use the pricing as an analogy, with the startup of US LNG, with the hub-based pricing and greater volumes of destination-free LNG coming up, it acts as a catalyst for change. What could the catalyst for change be for the emissions discussion we're having today? You know, so what is going to drive the change? Is it going to be the buyers, the sellers, the portfolio players or traders? What's going to drive it?
I actually think it's going to be regulation. Mm-hmm. So if you regard Europe as the sink market for global LNG, and if Europe has methane emissions standards, then can it be very long before others, you know, perhaps starting with Japan, also start to consider methane emission standards.
Yeah.
And this really depends on how seriously people are taking their COP21 targets and decarbonisation. But I mean, I just regard this as an unstoppable process. How long it will take is another matter. But given that the new FIDs are for 20 or 25 years, you can bet that within that time period, this is going to happen. And I would suggest you should be thinking about a 5 to 10 year period.
It's very interesting what you've just said, Jonathan, because I think I could repeat those exact words you said when we talked about pricing some years ago. But look, why don't we turn to offsets, which we briefly have referred to. Now, can LNG producers meet standards through relatively low-cost offsets, such as forest projects or low-cost biogas or biomethane? Or is the volume of these sufficient to match potentially large demand from the growing LNG sector?
I mean, I think it's a start, but I mean, the answer is no. It's the volume isn't going to be enough.
Mm-hmm.
Other measures have got to be taken. Now, an obvious first measure is whether a project can use renewable energy to power the liquefaction process.
Right.
To power any process throughout the value chain.
Mm-hmm.
And another obvious issue is whether you can capture methane which is being vented or flared at the upstream source.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are very easy things. We were at the IEA a little bit earlier this week. Mm-hmm. We were reminded about their work. We said 75% of methane emissions currently can be captured at zero or negative cost. In other words, you can make money if you capture these things.
Now, does that need new technology, or does it just need investment? What is stopping? It seems like a no-brainer.
It needs a change in behaviour and a bit of investment. For older facilities, it will require more investment.
Right.
For newer facilities, it really shouldn't be emitting too much methane anyway. But really, people have to examine every element in the value chain.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no good saying, oh, well, we're just in the liquefaction. We've got no control over the upstream.
You know, mm-hmm.
Basically, if you're in a value chain, you better know what's happening in your upstream because someone's going to ask you.
But it's interesting also when you look at the responses from the companies, and you know, we are recording this podcast in the week that BP has announced zero emissions by 2050, and BP, of course, being a very large trader of LNG. So it sounds to me like it might be some of the international companies with shareholders who are seeking environmentally clean companies that are going to be the drivers of this, isn't it?
I think that's right, partly because they've got both the interest and the balance sheets to do it. But one thing that I'm frustrated about, I mean, obviously we all welcome companies saying they're going to reduce their emissions, but the gas industry has a habit of answering questions that nobody is asking.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody is asking, what are the emissions of your company and how fast are you going to reduce them? What they're asking is, at the end of the value chain where I'm using this gas,
mm-hmm.
what is its emission footprint?
Yeah.
And that's why it's a value chain question, much more than a corporate question.
And I agree with you, and you and I have talked about before that, you know, as the bill of lading with LNG cargo is handed over, so will another certificate with the emission on it.
Indeed. And that's why this needs to be put in place. Even if you don't think this is going to become a requirement, you need to start doing this now because it will be a requirement sometime in the future.
And I think the future could be less than 5 years.
The other thing is, this is not asking people to build a carbon capture and storage plant. We're not asking for billions of dollars of investment. We're saying, measure your emissions,
mm-hmm.
get them certified, and basically have a piece of paper in your hand so that when a government or a regulator asks you, you can mm-hmm. produce it.
Yeah.
It's not a big deal in terms of money.
Just going back to one of the earlier points we were talking about, which is offsets and green LNG. You know, what about transforming methane into hydrogen? You know, with CCS. You know, in either exporting or importing countries. Surely that would impact on the project economics and affordability of LNG and relative to other energy choices, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. Now, in certain regions, and I think, you know, one thinks about Japan, which is already doing this in terms of shipping hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
I think we'll be seeing more steam reforming in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is the cost, because that you're asking somebody to build a CCS project, which we don't have in any significant form for at the moment, LNG. That is quite an important additional cost. that's going to impact on your cost base. But that will come, and it will have to come if gas and LNG are going to decarbonise.
And of course it needs to do, we've been doing quite a lot of work on reporting on this, haven't we? And I'll have to say our sponsors are very interested in this.
I think, I mean, I was astounded at the conference that you and I were at a few weeks ago. At the end of a very long day, we had a workshop, which I agreed to chair somewhat foolishly, and 50 people showed up to talk about hydrogen at the end of a very long day.
Yeah.
And when I basically said to them, well, why are you here? Most of them said, well, we've been told by our management, you need to find out about hydrogen.
Interesting. Now I was chairing one on pricing, and I certainly didn't have 50 people. So I think you've got a lot of people coming to us. The simple things, they don't understand it, do they?
Well, that's right. I mean, this is something that we've all heard about the hydrogen economy. But actually, what are the details here? What does it really mean? And what does it mean specifically for gas?
Well, look, why don't we just return to the narrative?
Right.
You know, in your earlier paper about LNG, you know, you said it needs to be delivered in kind of $4 to $6 per MMBTU range to be economic to new buyers in emerging markets. You know, I think I just wanted to ask you, is this still the case, and do you think it's realistic?
Well, it's still the case, and if we look at today's spot prices, it's definitely realistic. But I mean,
less than $3, we're $2.80.
But one of the things that is interesting is that for me, given how low spot prices are, we haven't seen the take-up in demand in some of, say, the South Asian countries that I would have expected.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reminded this week that, well, one of the reasons for that is, yes, the LNG is affordable, but do you have the infrastructure behind the regas plant to take it away? So it's not just price, you've got to, not just the price of the LNG, you've got to have the infrastructure to take it away as well.
So it's interesting, you know, because my next question was going to be about price elasticity in these markets, but it's almost infrastructure elasticity then, isn't it?
Well, what it means is, I think, that when importers in low-income countries see this level of spot price, they have to think, right, how long is this going to last?
Yep.
Is it worth building the infrastructure, which will be an additional investment? But then the question is, and after that, can we persuade our sellers to stick with the spot price and not go back to some oil-related price, which may be much, much higher?
Yeah, but if you believe in a world where we are developing spot markets, and some of the work we've been doing in the Institute about merchant markets, which will be completely hub-related pricing in the future, it's unlikely it's going to happen, isn't it?
I think you have to talk country by country here.
Yeah.
I don't think you can generalise. But what I would say is I think it's a secular trend.
Yeah.
And I think the trend from oil to market stroke hub prices is unstoppable. The only question is, how long is it going to take, and which country are we talking about?
Exactly. Well, it's interesting because one of the things we talk about at conferences, as indeed we talk a lot in the Institute, is about cost is important and the low cost projects will be successful. But you know, what about, you know, the higher cost energy supply projects? Are these ones going to be dead? You know, what's going to happen?
I hesitate to talk about anybody's project, but I would say is, if you have a project where you can't land your LNG for less than $7.58, better think very carefully about whether you want to do it.
No, but I think on the new projects you can think carefully. But you know, there are projects out there that have been constructed, of course, and you know, a lot of these projects are going to have to write off their costs.
They are going to have to write off their costs, or they are going to have to take write downs on their investments.
As we are seeing in actually quite a few
large
companies. No. Well, look, why don't we just go back and start talking about perhaps the emissions more? You know, because over the last years there's been a lot of talk of a global carbon price without much success in reality. And the LNG market has seen a huge rise in liquidity in paper trading indices such as the Asian spot price JKM and the newly emerging US Gulf LNG market price. So you know, could this drive the measure and managing of LNG emissions, encouraging finally a global carbon price? What do you think as we commoditize our world more?
I think that's a little bit optimistic.
Right.
For me, I don't think about a global carbon price. What I think about is what individual regions and countries are going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, you know, it doesn't matter so much that, for example, Trump has withdrawn the US from the Paris process, because what I see happening in individual states is in effect actually more ambitious than some of the things in the Paris process. Likewise, I think we need to be very clear about what big countries realistically are going to do, China and India among them, and we need to see whether what will happen in Europe if next month the EU adopts a net zero legally binding target, what impact that will have elsewhere.
Yeah.
But I think we shouldn't... Global issues, I think, are not that useful. We need to focus on regional and probably national issues.
But of course, a big global issue today is we see the coronavirus, you know, potentially growing even more. The world economy could be teetering as a result. You know, are we going to have a concern when global emissions are going to, perhaps the focus on emissions, are going to be less kind of important than actually developing the economy of these countries?
Well, that's right. But, I mean, for me, LNG and gas are not going to be the difference between developing and not developing.
Mm-hmm.
The key question for me in a lot of countries is, is their energy balance going to renewables and gas or mm-hmm. renewables and coal?
Right.
And that's an economic question, it's a resource availability question, and the LNG industry has got to take the view, if you want people to develop on renewables and gas,
mm-hmm.
then you need to have a certain level, or not above a certain level, of delivered cost and price.
Yeah, interesting. Well, look, I always, as you know, on these podcasts, like to end up with a kind of forward-looking question. So I think, where are we going to end up? It's, you know, with the whole certification of emissions on the LNG and gas LNG and gas pipeline value chains. Where are we? Where's the end game?
I think the end game is that as sellers and particularly exporters of gas and LNG, you need to have provisions in place within the next 5 years to show the emissions footprint of your product, wherever it's going to be delivered. That's not going to cost you a huge amount of money, and it's going to give you enormous credibility against those who say, well, actually, you're no better than coal, are you, because you've got all these methane emissions.
And if you don't?
And if you don't, you may well lose out to others who do, or you may be charged, or your buyer may be charged money for offsets because they don't believe or they don't have any demonstration of what your emissions are.
Interesting. And well, at the end of the podcast, you know, you've done 4 papers on this subject. Have you got a 5th one in the pipeline?
I'm not sure. I'll have to see how things develop. But it's going to be very interesting to see what the methane strategy actually includes from the Commission. And that's maybe going to be the trigger for the next paper.
But of course, that'll be European focused. It won't be global focused.
It won't be. But I wouldn't be surprised if people outside Europe take a lot of notice of it.
I think it's interesting. Well, we look with interest on that. Well, look, Jonathan, you know, thank you again for your time. As always, I've enjoyed chatting. We've chatted about a lot of things we didn't necessarily think we were going to talk about
Indeed,
today,
which is as usual.
As usual. And it certainly builds upon your paper, Challenges to the Future of LNG, Decarbonisation, Affordability and Profitability. And you can find this at our website, www.oxenergy.org, where you can also find all our podcasts in the multimedia folder, Jonathan's earlier papers on the future of gas, as well as other papers published by the Institute. As always, I hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast as much as I've enjoyed recording it. And thank you and goodbye to everyone.